Good morning.
Good morning.
There's a whole bunch of people missing have to do makeup exams. Next week's our last class. We're going to finish up Luke. And then you'll get a break with a decent teacher up here for a while instead of me. And I just really appreciate this chance to go through Luke. And as I've often said, the only reason I teach is because it's for my own benefit. It's the only way that forces me to learn anything. So I hope something slops over once in a while to your benefit. Last week we went hastily through chapter 21, which is the Olivet Discourse, in which Jesus, with a handful of his disciples, sits on the Mount of Olives and gives them an overview of the future. Looking down on the temple, the disciples had asked about the beautiful temple building, and Jesus had told them that it was going to be torn down, and which was startling and unbelievable to the disciples. But of course, it happened under General Titus some 40 years later, when the Romans besieged Jerusalem and tore the whole city down and killed 1 million people, exactly as Jesus had predicted. The main emphasis in chapter 21 of Luke is on the deception and the turmoil and the uncertainty that would elapse between the departure of Jesus and his return again. Remember, the disciples and everybody assumed that the kingdom of God was going to come in right away, and now it's been 2,000 years, and looking back over the 2,000 years, you see that the central warning of Jesus was to not be deceived, to tough it out, to hang in there, to lay hold of the power of God and to remain faithful, and that the whole world would be in turmoil for a long period of time with wars and earthquakes and famines. Now, the expanded version of the Olivet Discourse is in Matthew 24, and that's the subject of Ray Stedman's very, very good book, which they have in the bookstore. It goes into a great deal of more about the time period between the rapture of the church and the second coming, and it's full of all kinds of insights. And we then hastily went to chapter 22. The public ministry of Jesus has finished. He has arranged to have the Passover meal with his disciples in an arranged rented room or borrowed room. And he sends his disciples ahead to get the dinner ready. And we started in on that in chapter 22. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin, the leaders of the people, are desperately scrambling around to find a way to get Jesus and to put him to death one way or another. The mass of the people have not yet turned against Jesus, so they're a little skittish because of the crowd, the dangers of the crowd. But quite a few things happen at the Last Supper, and all four Gospels begin to pick up these events now at the beginning at the Last Supper. In the ordinary Jewish Passover, there would be four courses and four different cups of wine. The Gospel writers don't bother to talk about the whole dinner. They focus on essentially one cup, the breaking of the bread and the sharing of a common cup, which is for us today the memorial supper we call the Lord's Supper. Jesus used that part of the Passover meal to indicate that he was putting into effect the new covenant, which was be a radical different arrangement for living than the old covenant, which had prevailed up until that day. And that's the covenant that we are privileged to live under today, with better promises, the higher priesthood, the covenant that works by changing us from the inside out rather than by putting the demands of the law on us externally. So that's one of the important events. Also, at the Last Supper, we had the foot washing event, in which Jesus wrapped a towel around himself and washed the feet of the disciples to show that the kind of leadership he had in mind for them was servant based, that the greatest would be the servant of all. During the dinner, we have the exclusion of Judas, who, when his identity is revealed, and none of the disciples are aware of who he is, he gets out, he leaves. It says that Satan entered into him, which the second time, and then John adds, and it was night. So that's more than just symbolic that it was nighttime. That means that the darkness of evil is now upon all of the events to follow. Judas leaves. Last week we talked about the fact that at this otherwise wonderful dinner party in which Jesus is teaching these great things, there broke out this little dispute about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom of God, and that once again they're all vying among themselves for power and authority and who gets the best office and who gets the big low carpet on the floor and the best cubicle and so on. And Jesus once again had to remind them that they were to be servants, but he did say that, and we stopped at verse 30 of chapter 22, I bestow upon you, my disciples, my 11 disciples, a kingdom just as my Father bestowed one upon me, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So that's a prediction for the long-term future of Israel and the disciples and the kingdom of God and the integrity of Israel all the way to the end of the age, the end of the age we live in. Also in John, you remember John has this great teaching on loving one another. He has the promise of sending the Spirit, goes into detail about what the coming of the Spirit would do on the day of Pentecost. He tells them that he's leaving in order to prepare a place for them, that he'll come again. He gives this great teaching of the vine and the branches, you remember. And at the close of the meal, as they're walking out and over to the Garden of Gethsemane, along the way, we have recorded his great prayer, his great high priestly prayer in John 17, in which he entrusts the care of the disciples to the Father during the time that he's going through the ordeal of the cross, and prays for us too, those of us who will believe in him because of the testimony of those original 11. And that's a very, very powerful prayer. Well, those things are in the other Gospels. It's very important to read at this point for us to read all four. And I've suggested many times that you might want to get a harmony of the Gospels, which arranges the texts in parallel in columns so that you can see what one Gospel writer emphasizes and another leaves out. There's good reason why the individual authors emphasize what they did. Luke has his own particular emphasis. He knows all the rest of the details, but he doesn't bother to write them down. And, of course, John's gospel is radically different, comes way late, long after everybody else is dead. But we want to see what happens next in chapter 22, verse 31. Peter. Jesus has something to say to Peter that he spotted in Peter that he wants to bring out. And he says, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brothers. That's pretty ominous. Satan has asked permission from God to sift you, to try you, to test you. You're going to, in fact, you're always bragging about your dependability and reliability and service, but you're going to actually crumble and fail. But I've already prayed for you in advance that when you're restored, you would be a strength to your brothers. Well, now that's pretty radical. And, of course, Peter is outraged at this. Lord, I am ready to go with you both to prison and to death. And Jesus says, I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day before you deny three times that you know me. So there is a prediction that Peter would fail not once but three times. Job.
Job, yeah, where faith got permission to be a faith. Job,
seems to be similar. Satan only does things by the permission of God, and it would seem that Satan had asked permission to test Peter. But why? Why would God allow that? God wouldn't allow it unless there was some greater good to come out. And Peter is impetuous and sure of himself and impulsive, and he needs to mellow out a bunch. So he needs it. He needs to fail. Like sometimes we all need to fail rather drastically if we're much too self-confident and we're much too, we've got faults we won't deal with. Job had faults he wasn't aware of. So it's not whimsical. But it's interesting. Most of the time we enjoy God's protection. And Jesus, of course, here is interceding that Peter would come back, which he did. So this is not a fun thing that lies ahead for Peter, as we'll see. But it radically changes his whole life. On the day of Pentecost, we see a very, very different Peter. Now, Peter's always had the kind of leadership among the disciples. He was always the one with the natural leadership ability. And on the day of Pentecost, he takes the lead in the evangelism and the preaching. But he's not the first pope. Now then, Jesus reminds them of those early training sessions when he had sent them out alone to go village to village and share the gospel. And so he's indicating that they're going to be doing more of that after he's gone. He said to them, "When I sent you without money, bag, sandals, and sack, and you lacked nothing, did you lack nothing?" And they said, "Nothing." In other words, was I adequate to all your needs when I sent you out on those little training missions and you had nothing at all with you, neither food nor support? And they said, "Yeah, you took care of our needs." And now Jesus says, well, things are going to change a little bit. Now, he who has a money bag, let him take it, and likewise a sack, and he who has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. I say to you that that which is written must still be accomplished in me. And then he quotes, "He was numbered with the transgressors," quoting Isaiah, "for the things concerning me have an end." They said, "Lord, look, here are two swords." And he said to them, "It is enough." In other words, when you go out in the future, you're going to need to be a little bit more prepared. You're going to need money and food and preparation. Obviously, that's what we do when we send somebody out on a missionary journey, is we make sure they get their passports and visas and shots and take enough money along to get along. So obviously you don't go out empty-handed anymore. So that's it. Now you notice that they're already with their swords, their little swords that they carry around for just doing, like Swiss Army knives, to do little things. And Jesus says, that's enough, guys. Shut up now. We got other things to talk about. So they're all rushing right to get in on the action. With plenty of enthusiasm and still don't quite get what's going on. Well, the dinner, according to Luke, the dinner has now ended, and they all head out in the moonlight around to through the vineyards to the Mount of Olives. The Last Supper was traditionally held on Mount Zion, and you'd go south down into the Valley of Hinnom and around to the Kidron Valley to the Garden of Gethsemane. And so they walk on foot. Coming out, he went to the Mount of Olives as he was accustomed. The Garden of Gethsemane. Here we learn that Jesus very often retreated to this old olive garden. The olive trees are still there to this day, or many very old olive trees. And the Church of All Nations is there, and it's a very wonderful place to visit to this very day. But Jesus evidently retreated there when he wanted solitude and time of prayer, and he may well have spent the night there on several occasions when he had nowhere else to stay. The disciples followed him. Judas, meanwhile, has left the meeting and gone out to find the Jewish leaders so that he can lead them to the garden and arrest Jesus. When he came to the place, he said to them, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt and he prayed, saying, "Father, If it is your will, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Now, we know from this gospel and from the others that the disciples sort of went off and had a nap. In spite of the fact that there seems to be two things going on here, Jesus asked the disciples to pray that they might not enter into temptation. And from the other Gospels, you get the idea that Jesus would have appreciated their fellowship and their prayer during this agonizing time of his own greatest, deepest need, and they're sleeping conveniently right through it all. What do you suppose, right at the end of this prayer, he goes and wakes them up again right in verse 46. Why do you sleep? Rise and pray, lest you enter into temptation. What's the temptation, do you suppose, that Jesus is concerned about for the disciples that they ought to stay awake and be praying? What's he concerned about for them? Yes, that they would desert him or betray him. Peter is going to actually betray the Lord three times, and the others actually desert him. As we'll see, they actually do desert the Lord during the crucifixion, and they're very skeptical even after the resurrection, as we'll see. So they're pretty flaky right here in the garden. And verse 42, Jesus is praying to the Father in considerable anguish. An angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. Only Luke brings that out, that this was such a difficult time for Jesus emotionally that an angel was sent to strengthen him and comfort him. Being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling to the ground. When he rose up from the disciples and had come from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them sleeping from sorrow. So they're at least sad. Now, what is this great agony in the garden that causes Jesus such anguish, and such anguish that sweat breaks out on his forehead and with it blood? The most severe anguish that a person could go through in spirit. What is it that has come upon the Lord that causes him this great distress? Now, this is, to give you a hint also, that the book of Hebrews comments on this. What is it that for the first time in his whole life, Jesus realizes that what he's going to face tomorrow is a total separation from the Father. He and the Father have always stayed in intimate fellowship. He has never had any experience with sin or with failure. He's never disobeyed the Father. And he desperately would like to find in his own humanity, he'd like to find some other way for the redemption of mankind to be solved, to be worked out, except by the path of the cross, which lies right in front of him. If there's any other way, Father, can we possibly between us find another way? But nevertheless, whatever is your will, we'll do it. Now, the more you think about this, you realize that this is more there than you imagine, because on the cross, Jesus is going to become sin for us. He who knew no sin was made to be sin for us. The sins of the world are going to be transferred from us, from the whole world, onto him. He is going to be punished on our behalf. And that will mean that the man being punished on the cross is a guilty criminal, experiencing the full wrath of God against sin as a substitute. Now, if you would imagine yourself in that position, nothing could be more horrific or horrendous than not only to face the sins of one individual, but the sins of all of mankind. And in that 3 hours on the cross, to pay the price for the punishment of all the sins of all of mankind for all time, right down to the present day, that's part of what he realized would happen. This is the sinless Son of God, and in a sense, this is going to happen in eternity. And the little paper I gave you last week discusses the fact that although this is 6 hours on the cross, as far as the experience of Jesus, it's eternity. It's an eternity of bearing, of being the sin bearer, being the scapegoat that carries the sins out of the universe. Well, that's over. Comes the arrest. While he was still speaking, a multitude came. The whole bevy of Roman soldiers to arrest Jesus, you know, as if he was some very, very dangerous person, fully armed with these brave, bold disciples with their cannons and swords and dynamite and everything. But while he was still speaking, behold, a multitude, and then the one who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near to Jesus to kiss him. Jesus said to him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? Here's where we get the idea of the traitor's kiss. The two different words for kiss here. The second time it means Jesus mentions it's an intense lover's kiss, or it's a prolonged kiss, or but it's obviously this is the sign that Judas has given the Roman soldiers that to identify Jesus. So this is the kiss of the traitor, which is very lowly and very loathsome. And now comes Peter. When those around him saw what was going to happen, they said to him, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? We're ready to defend you against all this great army of Roman soldiers. Well, die in the process, but no matter. One of them, now that's Peter, struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. We know the man's name, Malchus. And that, the fact that his name is mentioned elsewhere suggests that he later became a believer. Jesus is not very happy with Peter's rash action and reaches down and gets the detached bleeding ear and puts it back and heals it right away, which is fortunate. Otherwise, Peter could have been arrested separately for removing an ear illegally. And so there's a healing here. And Jesus immediately wants to call attention to the disciples that his way is not the way of the sword. That's not how he's going to do things. Jesus said to the chief priests, captains of the temple, and the elders who had come to him, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me. How come you didn't come and publicly get me long before now? I'm harmless. But this is your hour and the hour of darkness. This is now your hour. The future demands on them in their service from him are going to be much more severe than any of the demands in the training sessions in and around Israel. It's not so much military swords he's talking about as it is the utilitarian swords a fisherman would carry or anybody would carry for ordinary things. But if that's all you had to defend yourself with, he's just saying take whatever you have when you're going to need all of your resources when you serve me in the future. No, I don't think he's emphasizing. He's just saying, use all the resources that are at your disposal in the days to come. Which is true, isn't it? When you go out on a short-term mission or a long-term mission. Now, the night time, evening time, it's after dark. And it's after dark spiritually as well as by the calendar. And the events is there's a whole bunch of things happen. The first thing that happens is the soldiers take Jesus to the house of Annas, who's the father-in-law of the active high priest Caiaphas. Caiaphas is the official high priest. Annas has got his finger in all the money in the temple. And these are political offices right now. These are paid for bribe offices. These are not legitimate Levitical priests who are godly men at all. They're politicians and they're crooked and they sort of run things. And Jesus first makes an appearance to Annas briefly. Having arrested him, they led him and brought him to the high priest's house. They take him shortly after that to the house of Caiaphas. So that he's going to go around several places. Peter followed at a distance. Didn't say what the other disciples did. They seem to have sort of vanished. Probably some of the other disciples followed, or we wouldn't have any written accounts. But they're staying in the background. You don't find them rushing up to identify with Jesus and to say, hey, we're with him. They're not defending him or anything like that. And it's cold. It's cold evening in March. When they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. A certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, this man was also with him. Just an ordinary servant girl saying, oh, I saw this man, Peter, with Jesus. That's pretty innocuous. Servant girl is no great danger to anybody. But Peter denied him, saying, woman, I do not know him. First of the failures of Peter, I don't know him. An out-and-out lie. It just slips right out. That's how easy it is to lie, just when you fail, when the spirit fails. A little while later, while another saw him and said, you also are one of them. And Peter said, man, I am not. Somebody else, some other person in the courtyard. As if Peter was going to get himself in any big trouble. At this point in time, he's not. The leaders will arrest and kill Jesus, and they probably won't bother with the disciples. But Peter now has twice in a row denied Jesus while all this interrogation is going on in the house of the high priest. After about an hour had passed, another servant or ordinary person in the courtyard. Remember the open houses they had in Jerusalem where there was a courtyard and pretty accessible to the public, and you could build a fire out there to stay warm. After about another hour, somebody else passed by. Surely this fellow also was with him. This man, Peter here, obviously is a Galilean. Tell from the way he dresses, he's from Galilee. Peter said, man, I do not know what you are saying. Denial number three. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. That would tell you that it's getting up to be about 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. By the Roman clock, the rooster crows 3 a.m. And just at that moment, Jesus passes out of the house and looks Peter right full in the face right while he's in the middle of this denial. And so there's Jesus looking at Peter, who has just denied the Lord for the third time. And of course, Luke, who likes to tell us about the humanity and the emotions and the feelings of human beings, wants us to see the anguish that Peter felt and, of course, the Lord's disappointment, which he had anticipated. The Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And Peter went out and wept bitterly. So there's the breaking and humbling of Peter as he sees that the prophecy was fulfilled, and he's horrified that he could do something like betray the Lord. Later on, Jesus pays special attention to Peter after the resurrection to get Peter restored, as you probably know. The men who held Jesus mocked him and beat him, and having blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and ask him, saying, prophesy, who is it that struck you? And many other things they blasphemously spoke against him. Since the leadership is now against Jesus, it's okay for the Roman soldiers and the guards to taunt Jesus and to ridicule him and humiliate him and to have a little sport. And the Roman soldiers didn't like the Jews anyway, and so they're not going to get in any trouble if they hit him and blaspheme him. And as soon as it was day, the elders and the people, both chief priests and the scribes, came together and led him into their council, saying, if you are the Messiah, tell us. What we don't see here in Luke is that in the middle of the night, Annas and Caiaphas had gathered most of the Sanhedrin together secretly to see if they couldn't get a guilty verdict. And they realized that it was illegal for the Sanhedrin to meet in the middle of the night, and so they had to reconvene the Sanhedrin at daylight, which they did. That would be the full 70 leaders. And now they've got the Sanhedrin assembled, for this formal hearing. Now, there are some very, very good books written by lawyers on the trial of Jesus and many, many things. Everything was done wrong and done illegally. As a matter of fact, if you look a little carefully at what the gospel writers tell us, Jesus is really in charge of all of these events. It is really not he who is on trial. Everyone else is on trial, and he's the judge. And the way the justice works out is that in the long run, the Lord will be vindicated, and all of his accusers will be shown to be the crooks and criminals that they really are. But now he's in front of the Sanhedrin. If you are the Messiah, tell us. And he said to them, if I tell you, you will by no means believe. What do you think I've been talking about for 3 years in Jerusalem? You've had plenty of time to evaluate my claims. I will also ask you, if I also ask you, you will give me no answer. You will by no means answer me or let me go. Nothing I say is going to change your mind. Your mind's already made up. I know what you guys are. This is a mock trial. This is not a legal trial with witnesses conducted by the law. Hereafter, the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. I know what's going on. God and I are in full charge of all these events. Let it proceed. They all said, are you then the Son of God? And he said to them, you rightly say that I am. Yeah, you're right. That's what I've been saying. That's who I am. And they said, what further testimony do we need? You've heard it. We've heard it. This is a confession. We've heard it from your own mouth. We don't need to haul in any witnesses. You've blasphemed God by claim to be the Messiah. Of course, he really was the Messiah, so it was hardly blasphemy. The whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. Now, it's interesting that in the Sanhedrin there were some believers, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, and they seemed to have kept quiet. They could have protested or said something they didn't, apparently. And not all 70 of these Sanhedrin were by any means out-and-out enemies of Jesus, but they went along with the crowd. So you get this kind of unanimous verdict. They begin to accuse him, saying, we found this fellow. They take him to Pilate. They lead him now. The whole mob takes him to Pilate. Pilate's up having breakfast. Take him around to Pilate's house. And they tell Pilate, we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he is the Messiah, a king. Now, Pilate's a politician, and he's shrewd, and he's clever, and he's corrupt, and he's anxious to preserve his good standing with Caesar. And he doesn't care at all about Jesus perverting the nation. That happens all the time. He'd be a little bit worried about somebody that was discouraging the payment of taxes, and he would be worried that anybody was genuinely trying to overthrow Caesar by being a superior king. So Pilate's got a little mild interest in this man, Jesus. Pilate asked him, saying, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered him and said, it is as you say. Pilate said to the chief priests in the crowd, I find no fault in this man. Pilate looks over all these charges and looks at Jesus and actually believes in his heart that Jesus is innocent. But Pilate believes that right to the end of the whole story. So Pilate is wishy-washy and compromising, always careful about his reputation and his standing with Caesar, not at all hesitant to do something wrong if it protects his own career. They were the more fierce, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place. Now Pilate sees a way out here. That mention of Galilee tells him that Herod is in charge of Galilee, so this is a good excuse for him to send him over to Herod. Maybe Herod will come up with some additional incriminating evidence so that Jesus can be put to death. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean, and as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who happened to be in Jerusalem at that time. This is the Herod who had executed John the Baptist. When Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, long been curious about this man he'd heard about. He wanted to meet him for a long time, just out of curiosity. He'd heard many things about him, and he hoped to have Jesus do some miracle for him. Pull off some miracle for me and entertain me, kind of thing. Herod questioned him with many words, but Jesus answered nothing. He said nothing. Why did Jesus say nothing to Herod? It's because who Herod is. He claims to be the king, but who is he really? Where is he from? He's an Edomite. Edom stands for the flesh. What does God have to say to the flesh? Nothing. What do you say to the man who claims to be the king of the Jews but isn't? The total fraud? Nothing. So Jesus says nothing to him. Must have exasperated Herod quite a bit. The chief priests and the scribes stood and vehemently accused Jesus. They're just in there yelling and shouting at Jesus. Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt. Now, Herod's not a nice guy. Mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. And you find in the other Gospels that Jesus was beaten and given a crown of thorns, beaten badly with a Roman scourge with bits of bone and metal embedded in it that tear the flesh off your back. So he's spit upon. That very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other. Before that, they had been at enmity with each other. Now the rivalry between these two sort of disappeared, and they've got Jesus as a common enemy. So Jesus gets back to Pilate. Pilate, when he had called the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning the things of which you did accuse him." And Herod didn't either. Neither did Herod. "I sent you back to him, and nothing worthy of death has been found in him. I will chastise Jesus and release him." Well, now, why do you chastise? Why do you beat an innocent man or scourge him and release him? What do you do that for? Well, you do that to please the crowd, obviously. At the Passover, a criminal is ordinarily pardoned and forgiven. It was necessary for Pilate to release one of the prisoners to them at the feast. They all cried out, saying, "Away with this man and release us instead Barabbas." There's this condemned criminal who had been in prison for insurrection and for murder. So there's no question about him being a really bad guy. And Pilate has the option of turning Barabbas loose and pardoning him, or turning Jesus loose and pardoning him. What does the word Barabbas mean? Son of the Father. Isn't that interesting? That Son of the Father is going to be pardoned and released and sent free, and the Son, the real Son of the Father, who's innocent, is going to be put to death. Isn't that interesting? We all represent Barabbas, you know. We are all the guilty sons of the Father who are going to be forgiven and set free, and the real Son of the Father is going to go die in our place. So that's a good way to kind of think about Barabbas. Each of us deserves the death that Barabbas had in store for him, and he's forgiven, and somebody else pays his price. Pilate, wishing to release Jesus, Pilate really would like to find a way to get Jesus off the hook for his own conscience. Remember, Pilate's wife had a dream about him, too. That's in one of the other Gospels. They shouted, saying, "Crucify, crucify him." He said to them for the third time, "Why, what evil has he done? I found no reason for death in him. I'll chastise him and let him go." They were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified. That's the chief priests and the religious leaders in the Sanhedrin are the ones that are all stirring up the crowd. The voices of these men and the chief priests prevailed and turned public opinion. Finally, you get the whole public opinion turned against Jesus, the people that previously had supported him. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested. The Jews had long ago lost the ability to carry out criminal punishment, and when they needed a criminal punished, they had to go to the Romans. That's why it ends up with Pilate here. Pilate released to them the one they requested, released Barabbas, who for insurrection and murder had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Jesus to their will, to the will of the people. How's that for being an honorable leader, authority, government official? Now, so it's predetermined Jesus is going to die, period. Right or wrong, guilty or innocent, the whole crowd is determined. And remember elsewhere, the other Gospels, what the people said. The people now said, let his blood be upon us. How would you like to have been in that crowd among those people who said, may the blood of Jesus be upon us? We take the responsibility for the death of this man, Jesus. How about that? How about that hanging on your head before God down through the centuries? That shows, I think, clearly that Jesus, that there is a guilt that Jewish people share uniquely in the death of Jesus, though all of us share in the guilt of the death of Jesus. But the Jews particularly. Now, that's why, and Jesus in the end of the age is the comes back as the avenger of blood. And the city of refuge, it comes back to deal with, and he comes back, at the second coming, he has to deal with his own countrymen in the matter of his own shed blood. His own countrymen have this unique place. And hence, in World War III, is this great amount of Jewish blood is shed at the end of the age. Remember, we got that in the Old Testament a bit. Well, the way of the cross, the Via Dolorosa, if you go to Jerusalem, they take you through the city streets along this long path out to the place of execution. And he's carrying the cross arm of his cross, probably. And he's stumbling and weak from the all night, from the beatings and the torture and the lack of sleep and the strain. And when he stumbles and falls, the Roman soldiers recruit Simon from Cyrene, who happened to be visiting Jerusalem, and they ask him to carry the cross. Simon is probably a black man, and he's mentioned. He mentions in one of the other Gospels his two sons, the names of his two sons, and we find those two sons appearing in Paul's letter to the Romans. So we think that Simon, grumbling and complaining, is conscripted to carry the cross of Jesus, but it changes his whole outlook on life, becomes converted, leads his family to the Lord, probably goes back to Africa and helps start a church there. That's just a little side note. So he's probably, Arthur Custon says that Shem, Ham, and Japheth all have a role in the crucifixion, and this would be the place that Ham, the sons of Ham, have in the death of Jesus. A great multitude of the people followed him, and the women who mourned and lamented him. No sign of the disciples here. They don't seem to be busy following their Lord or helping carry the cross or doing any comforting or anything like that. What does Jesus say? To these dear, faithful, loyal women, he says, daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed, the days are coming in which they will say, blessed are the barren, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts which never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and say to the hills, and cover us. If they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry? This may be a very terrible day, but something more terrible is going to come to you and to your children and to the future, which is prophetically true. So don't feel sorry for me. There also were two other criminals led to the place of crucifixion at the same time. You probably know about the old rugged cross on a hill far away. It probably was not on a high hill. Probably, I think, at the Damascus Road, just outside of the north of the temple. Now also, there, wood is scarce, so this is not a nice big wood beam cross like churches have. It's probably an old olive tree used over and over again, and whatever wood that could be pressed into service. The Romans crucified hundreds and hundreds of people, left them dying along the roadways as a lesson to the Jews to be something for the worst of all the criminals. The prisoners are stripped naked right along the public highway at eye level. So this is not way up on a remote hill. This is as humiliating as you could possibly make it. And that means people can come and spit on the prisoners. They can come and curse them. They come and laugh and mock. And it's and Jesus is put to death along with two well-known criminals just to make sure everybody knows that he is a criminal. When they came to the place of the skull, the place called Calvary, where they crucified him, I think this is right outside what's called the Garden Tomb. That's my personal opinion. And if you visit the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem, that could well be the tomb. We don't know. There are tombs from the first century in that area. And on the hillside, which is Mount Moriah, and it is Golgotha, there is a skull-like feature that's been there for centuries. Happens to be an Arab bus station in front of it now, but you can ignore that. When they had come to the place called Calvary, they crucified him there, the criminals, one on the right and one on the left. Now we get the first of the seven words from the cross, which is the yellow sheet. For the first 3 hours of his time on the cross, Jesus is a great high priest interceding for the world. For the second 3 hours, Jesus becomes the victim, the sacrifice. The first of his prayers is, Father, forgive them. They do not know what they do. That gets the murder charge reduced from murder in the first degree to murder in the second degree, which is a big deal for all of us. Father, forgive them. They do not know what they do. They divided his garments and cast lots, exactly as predicted in the Old Testament. He had this seamless robe that the women had made for him. But they take all of his garments and divvy them up, and the seamless robe stays intact. The people stood looking on, and the rulers sneered, saying, He saved others, let him save himself, if he's the Messiah, the chosen of God. The soldiers also mocked him, coming and offering him sour wine, vinegar, and saying, If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. Come down from the cross. Now, and Pilate has an inscription written in letters over him, This is the King of the Jews, written in three languages, and hanging it over him on his head so everybody will know it's the King of the Jews. Well, if Pilate has written something that's accurate and true, this is the King of the Jews. There were Jews there that recognized that the way the Hebrew was written, that's exactly what it said. This is the King of the Jews. And they tried to get him to change the inscription, but he wouldn't change it. Because it's very obvious that Pilate got it right. This is the King of the Jews, and we're killing him. One of the criminals who were hanged alongside of Jesus cursed him, saying, If you are the Christ, save yourself and us. The other criminal on the other side answered, rebuking him, saying, Do you not fear God, seeing that you're under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. So something's happening in the second criminal on the adjacent cross. He said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, forgiving him immediately and regenerating him and bringing him into the faith, said, Assuredly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. When I die a few hours from now, I will take you with me to paradise. Just like that. Pretty amazing. It was about the sixth hour. That's noon. Jesus is crucified 9 a.m. Local time. And at noon, something happens that has never been explained to this present day. The whole sky becomes darkened for 3 hours. 3 solid hours of darkness. Over the land of Israel, maybe over the whole earth, nobody knows, and nobody knows the cause. Eclipses of the sun last a few minutes. Eclipses of the moon are at night, and this is broad daylight at noon. This darkness obviously is from God. It may be, it's sort of like the sun hid his face in shame from the horror of the cross. But what a frightening event to have the sun suddenly go dark for 3 solid hours, right in the middle of the execution, when the sins of the world are all laid upon Jesus. The sun was darkened, and the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. This great, heavy, thick veil between the holy place and the Holy of Holies is torn in two. And Hebrews goes into detail to tell us what that means symbolically. It means that the access into the Holy of Holies is now open to all of us, not just to the high priest and not once a year. We also read in the other Gospels that there was a great earthquake at this time. So God's punctuating this event as cosmic and important and not to be forgotten. When Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." So you notice in the earlier saying he had said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" That would seem to be the place at which the Father turned his wrath upon his own Son and punished his own Son in our place. And in anguish, Jesus cried out, "Father, why have you forsaken me?" And the work of the dying for our sins begins. But when it's all done, it is finished, and he dismisses his spirits. So he wasn't put to death. He wasn't killed. He voluntarily surrendered his life to the Father. So who's in control of the whole thing all the whole time? Jesus is. God is. So this is not being done to him as somebody that's a helpless victim. It's all arranged between him and the Father. When the centurion saw, the immediate centurion in charge of the Roman soldiers there, saw what had happened, he glorified God, saying, "Surely this was a righteous man." Surely. At this same time, one of the soldiers came up with a spear and pierced the side of Jesus, and out came blood and water, the plasma, and to indicate that Jesus really was dead. For him to have died in 6 hours was unusual, because prisoners very often would live for days on the cross. If somebody didn't die on time and you wanted to hurry up their death, you could come along with a stick and break the legs of the man, and then we're making it impossible for him to lift himself up and breathe, and he would die quickly. But Jesus is conveniently dead, and it's not yet the Sabbath. The whole crowd who came together to that site, seeing what had been done, beat their breasts and returned. That's a sign of anguish or mourning or grief or sorrow or something. All his acquaintances and the women who followed him from Galilee stood at a distance watching these things. His relatives and his family and the women seemed to be there. No sign of the disciples. Now, they might have been there, or some of them were, but they're not conspicuous. And we find also in John's Gospel says that Nicodemus, now who's in the Sanhedrin, goes out and buys 100 pounds of rare spices and brings them to the tomb so that that Jesus can be essentially covered with spices. So Nicodemus, the man that Jesus met in the garden at night earlier, has become a believer secretly. And now another man comes forth from the Sanhedrin, Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy man, a good and just man, another believer, comes and loans his tomb just for the weekend. He had consented to their counsel and their deed. He had not consented. So secretly, he had not agreed with their wanting to put Jesus to death. But neither, if he said anything, it didn't do any good. He was from Arimathea, a city of the Jews, and he himself was waiting for the kingdom of God, that he was believing in the coming of the kingdom, these righteous men. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. So once the side of Jesus has been pierced, you can go to Pilate and tell him that Jesus is dead, and now can we bury him before the Sabbath starts? And Pilate says, "Oh yeah, go ahead, bury him." And Joseph has conveniently made his tomb available, which had never been used. They took down the body of Jesus, wrapped it in linen, probably in spiral linen wrappings, probably not like the Shroud of Turin. Can't be positive, but it's probably spirally wrapped. And they laid, they put his body in a tomb where no one had lain before. And then we know from the Gospels that a great heavy stone was rolled across the entrance. And we also know from John that that Pilate, to make sure the body wasn't stolen away, put Roman soldiers to guard the tomb and put a seal on the tomb just to make sure that he stays good and dead. The day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew near. The women who had come with him from Galilee followed after him, and they observed the tomb, and they saw how his body was laid. So once again, it is the women who follow the body to the tomb and see where the tomb is located and are ready to embalm the body and to give him and make sure that his burial is decent. But it's now the Sabbath. They returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they had to leave them all there at the tomb and go back to their homes because it was now sunset and the Sabbath had come in. And that's the end of the story, with considerable detail supplied in the other Gospels. And so the Savior of the world is dead and buried, and clearly dead, clearly buried in a sealed Roman tomb, and there's no hope for the world. And the darkest hour of for mankind. But that's not the end of the story. As the next week, we'll see what follows. Now, anything in here that troubles you, or it ought to trouble you, but anything here that is maybe unclear or you'd like to, we're over time. Anil, how about you closing us in prayer today, would you?
Thank you.